Joined once again by John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Hello.
Good morning.
All right. I should just be happy that you responded within a couple seconds this week, shouldn't I?
We're awake.
Job's always messing with
me. That's because the drugs kicked in earlier this week. So.
All right. Well, we're going to try and repeat that next week. So lots to cover. It seems the last few weeks that there's been a lot of news, a lot of things to report. Here in Seattle, something that made the news a little bit, but not in much detail.
And not nearly enough.
It was a flash and it disappeared.
Looks like the third runway might cost more than they originally predicted.
Oh, yeah.
A wee bit.
Folks will remember that when Sound Transit announced that their costs had nearly doubled, that there was a huge brouhaha, and it stayed in the media for a long time. And
as there should have been. Yeah.
Yeah, and people were talking about whether or not to really build the Sound Transit light rail. But with the announcement this week, at the port of Seattle, that the new third runway would cost almost triple what it had originally been estimated, it's amazing to me that nobody has continued the story and nobody has caused an uproar over this. This thing was estimated to cost about $405 million in 1995 when it was first proposed. And then in 1999, the cost was revised to $773 million, which is about a 91% increase, almost doubling the cost. And there was a little bit of a stink made over that, but not much. That disappeared pretty quickly. And now this week they've announced that it's going to cost about $1.2 billion. That's almost triple the original cost, and nobody's saying anything.
Yeah, can you give us those numbers again very quickly?
Started out at $405 million in 1995. And then in 1999, it was revised to $773 million. That's about a 91% increase. And then this week, they announced $1.18, which is about $1.2 billion, which is almost tripling the cost of the third runway.
And to what are they attributing the increase in cost?
Well, of course, they want to say that it's the environmental people out there who are trying to stop, and the people who live next to SeaTac who are trying to stop the construction of the third runway, who have driven up costs by filing lawsuits and by riling up the State Department of Ecology and trying to stop permits that the third runway needs in order to get built. But the fact of the matter is that the Port of Seattle is very inefficiently run, and there's no oversight. And in fact, even by jumping through all the hoops and by lobbying the legislature and talking to legislators who have been very, very willing to listen and wanting to help, and legislators who have actually helped the Port of Seattle get exemptions to environmental laws and permit processes, that even in the face of all of that stuff, the third runway is not getting built on time and within the budget, even the revised budget that was double the initial amount.
And for those permits, and they've actually been denied some of those permits, and there have been several cases where the port has had to continue to refile the applications before they get them signed off. And this is an agency that has not failed to give the go-ahead to major public works projects in, like, decades. You know, every agency in the state that has had a major public works project has sailed through the same process that the Port of Seattle has had so much trouble with. That's not the public opposition from Des Moines and Buren and the city of SeaTac that's causing that. That's the nature of the project and the incompetence of the port in doing their own homework.
Right. And you have to recall, too, that after September 11th, air traffic fell dramatically throughout the nation, particularly at SeaTac, and that with the economic downturn, fewer people are flying and taking summer vacations, et cetera. Fewer businessmen are flying. And there's been a big slump in air travel through the SeaTac airport. So we really have to ask the question that was asked about light rail. Do we really need this? Now, we know that we need a mass transit system. You know, I mean, it might be light rail, it might be something else. We know we need a mass transit system, but we don't know that we need a third runway at this point. And the fact that the costs have tripled and that nobody is saying, gosh, should we even build this thing, is just amazing to me. It's the influence of business in this area. Yeah. Boeing really wanted the third runway, and they still really want the third runway, even though it's not clear whether Boeing will even stay in the region.
Yeah, and there really is a tendency, and I don't know if it's because it's a fairly obscure agency or because they're hardwired into the, sort of the political and civic elite of the area, but the Port of Seattle in general seems to get an extraordinary free pass from the media here. It really is one of the most corrupt and unaccountable public agencies in the region. And, you know, they get away with tax increases, they get away with frittering away money on sweetheart deals to an extent unimaginable for any other agency. The runway project really is environmentally very, very bad. The land underneath the area where they're talking about building it is a former landfill. It's a toxic stew, according to a couple of the industrial hygienists I've talked with who've looked at the soil hydrology there, and it runs directly into the Puget Sound through the creek and the watershed that runs through the area. And that's just one of the problems environmentally as well as the transportation.
There's also the question of filling in wetlands that are nearby.
Yeah.
And what will happen to the water that runs off that huge, huge area of pavement? Where is it going to go? It's going to be dirty because it'll be carrying gas and airline fuel and all kinds of other toxic substances used to de-ice planes and to clean things up around there. And it's going to go directly into the Sound and into wetlands nearby. So there's a lot of environmental problems with the third runway, but nobody's even pointing that out right now at a time when people should be saying, what? $1.2 million? What are you talking about? $1.2 billion? What are you talking about for this thing we may not even need for this environmental disaster?
Well, it might be that Boeing wants it, but there has been not one single airline that uses the SeaTac airport that's actually signed on to this thing. It's a good deal either. They've all refused to sign that.
It's
so
primarily
that's
the port.
A pretty key indicator.
And, yeah, it's primarily the port, and it's Boeing that
And,
want
you
this.
Know, if Boeing is leaving the region, it's not just that we shouldn't care about what they want politically or that it's going to result in reduced air traffic. That also brings the question of what about Payne Field? What about Boeing Field? And whether that could be used instead or some variation of that to divert air traffic.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's move on. The Supreme Court was getting a lot of media play this week.
Yeah, they did. They had a couple different affirmative action decisions. The local media headlines that affirmative action is upheld was just a little bit misleading. It was a little bit more of a split decision than that. I think maybe the surprise came because everybody just assumed that it would be struck down because it is such a conservative court. But at the same time, there were aspects of it that were upheld. It really is somewhat analogous to what the courts at the federal level and to a lesser extent the Supreme Court have been doing with reproductive rights over the last 20 years or so, which is steadily narrowing the definition of ways in which race can be used as a determinant. The basic idea of affirmative action, that you're using it as a way to redress, systematize institutional racism over a period of decades and generations, that is pretty much out the window. The idea that there is a societal imbalance in how people of color are treated and that it is important to take, affirmative, positive, proactive action to try and fix that, which really was not that controversial 30 years ago when it came in. I mean, it was pretty broadly acknowledged that something had to be done, and that, the reason something had to be done was institutionalized poverty, another concern that no longer seems to be a political concern, even though the gap between rich and poor is much worse now.
Poor are overwhelmingly people of color.
And the poor are overwhelmingly people of color, and that not only is it worse, but it's getting worse. It's continuing to grow, and we've got a number of economic policies now signed off on by both parties that are institutionalizing not just the poverty, but the increase in the gap between rich and poor and the lack of class mobility, the making it much more difficult for people who are, you know, growing up in disadvantaged circumstances, one-parent households, poor educational systems. You know, how do you break through all of that? How do you break through all of it when higher education is so expensive right now, when you can't get out of the high schools with, you know, the high schools don't even teach you how to read and write, etc. It really is a situation where affirmative action isn't going to help any of that. And that was the original purpose of it, no matter how narrowly defined, point systems that can maybe add a point here or there for a non-white applicant. And the fact that the debate has shifted from helping the economically disadvantaged, helping to address institutionalized racism, to providing cultural diversity, adding to the richness of the educational experience.
For white people in college.
For white people, yeah, which is considered to be the standard. And you know, the idea, of course, that white people, since desegregation of the public schools is no longer particularly considered an issue, that white people would have to wait until college, those people, those whites who go to college, in order to be exposed to other cultures, particularly once you get outside, you know, metropolitan areas like Seattle, where there is some diversity in some areas. The nature of that debate really has fundamentally shifted. That being said, it could have been thrown out entirely, and it was not. So, you know, that does leave a little bit of a window for policy changes in the future should the pendulum swing back in the other direction. More surprising, I think, and somewhat heartening, was the decision on sodomy, which overturned Bowers v. Hardwick in 1986, which I have some wonderful memories of being on staff for the civil disobedience action on the steps of the Supreme Court a year later that protested that. And, you know, you had the S&M guys who showed up with their own handcuffs, and the radical fairies chanting at the AIDS phobic police that, you know, their gloves didn't match their shoes. It was really quite a bit of fun, and very empowering. And, you know, the big marches on Washington in that era were very empowering, and that was kind of the point. But nobody really expected at that point, you know, there weren't any other cases before the Supreme Court challenging the couple dozen states that still had laws on the books prohibiting contact, oral genital contact, which were laws that were never enforced against heterosexuals, even though many heterosexuals practice that kind of sex as well.
And even though in some states it was on the books that it was to apply to heterosexuals as well, it was never enforced.
But it was never enforced that way. It was specifically used as a tool, as a legal tool against homosexuality. What has changed in the past 17 years is essentially the attitude of society and that really is where you get changes in bigotry like that. And I thought it was fascinating that Strom Thurmond died on the same day as this decision. And for whatever else may be said about Strom Thurmond, and that, you know, you can certainly say many noxious things about his politics and his legacy. But here was a guy who ran as an overt segregationist for president in 1948, as Trent Lott reminded us not too long ago. And, you know, he survived for another half century in the Senate because in his own home state, he stopped making war against the blacks. He made his peace with them. He actually shifted in a way that the old Dixiecrats and even people like Jesse Helms never did. But the way bigotry often ends is when the old generation dies off and the new generations who are more broad, you know, more broad thinking, more tolerant, come in and begin to take the reins of power. And that's what's happened in 17 years with queers, where you have gay folks and lesbians on television shows that actually are not cardboard characters who are there specifically because of their homosexuality, but they have fully developed characters. You know, you have people who are out in the halls of Congress and corporate America. You know, they're really the only two places where you don't have it at this point are in the military and in professional sports, and that's just a matter of time. So you have shifts like that, and it's much more often that things like that take place than that legislation or or demonstrations provide an abrupt shift in something. So in this case, really the Supreme Court was following culture, rather than being in the forefront. And that really, particularly given the context of the political shift in the last couple of decades, is I think where most of the important radical social change is happening right now. It's happening in the hearts of the public, and the politicians and the lawmakers and the judges are really following pretty far behind in a lot of important ways.
Let's hope the Pope follows too.
Yes, that would be very, very nice. And not just on
and
the question of homosexuality.
Leaders.
Yes.
Not just the Pope. There are other religious leaders who need to follow as well.
That's very true. And, you know, to give props to that, also there are a number of really quite wonderful congregations here in the Seattle area who've been national leaders in advocating for you know, out pastors to lead their congregations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in many different ways, it's people who know gay folk, who have them in their lives, who are them themselves and who are visible, that are changing public mores. And of course we have the march tomorrow, and we have yet another Gay Pride weekend.
Yeah,
and a lot of things going on in Capitol Hill this weekend.
People should turn out and celebrate.
Yeah, it should be a big party tomorrow at noon on Capitol Hill on Broadway.
All right, well, moving along, and speaking of religious leaders, it sounds like Afghanistan... Afghanistan has their fair share.
We're going to have to explain why we're all cracking up at that line.
Okay. In Afghanistan, you have a new draft constitution circulating, and I tell you, it is not very much at all like our own constitution.
Or the democracy that we promised would be coming into Afghanistan,
right,
which is why we invaded, right?
The draft is a secret document. It is not an open document that the public in Afghanistan or the public here in the U.S. can read at all. There are just a few people working on the document, a committee of nine of Afghanis who were selected by the various groups that have control of the country right now, sent a member to that council. They're the people who drafted the document. There are a few members of the Afghan government who have seen it, and many officials in Washington, D.C. with security clearances have read it, and a couple of human...
Sorry, security clearances in order to read a constitution. That's
yeah,
good.
In order to read the new constitution, the new draft constitution for Afghanistan, and a couple of human rights groups have actually been briefed by people who think that this whole process is screwed, have actually leaked it to a couple of human rights groups, and they've been able to comment to the press about what is in that draft constitution. Now, it turns out that there are no equal rights for women or ethnic minorities ensured in the document. There is no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of religion. There is no firm commitment to international treaties. The document would permit death by stoning for sexual crimes and other inhumane punishments. And people who criticize the government could be jailed as blasphemers. In short, it's a lot like how the Taliban ruled Afghanistan. How did this happen? Well, it happened because the process is top secret. That's why it happened, and it happened because a lot of the groups that sent representatives to this nine-member committee to draft the Constitution are religious fundamentalists and are very, very conservative, and they liked the way that the Taliban ruled the country, and they would like to rule rule Afghanistan in exactly the same way. Now, the process will continue in October when the Loya Jirga will convene in order to ratify the document, and it will not be made public until September 1st, so just a month before the Loya Jirga convenes, people will get a chance to actually read it. Right now, it seems apparent that officials in Washington, D.C. are pretty happy with the way the process is going now, and they don't want people to make a lot of changes, and they don't want an uproar to happen, and that's why this has been a top-secret process. But folks should know that there is not real democracy in store for Afghanistan. What's in store is a constitutional version of what the Taliban had.
Well, you've got a Bush administration that routinely in Congress has has put out, you know, copies of important legislation, you know, big, thick documents, only a few hours before lawmakers are expected to vote on them. So I'm wondering which way the process goes here, whether the Bush administration is happy that the Constitution itself has been top secret, or whether they're taking notes and want to present a new Constitution to Congress, you know, sometime in the future that they'll only get a few hours on. So. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty clear too that this new constitution for Afghanistan has a lot of things that the Bush administration would like for us here in the U.S., like no freedom
death
of
by
speech,
stoning.
Death by stoning, no equal rights for women and ethnic minorities, etc.
Yeah, right. Well, that's good news.
Well, and it also brings up the question of what happens in the future in Iraq, because, mm-hmm. you know, not very much can be signed off on in Afghanistan without the approval of the Bush administration, even though, the Karzai government really de facto does not have control of the country. Mm-hmm. So a document like this absolutely could not move forward without the approval of the Bush administration.
That's right.
All right. Well, speaking of Iraq, things continue to apparently get worse there.
Yeah, exactly. This week in Iraq, I think the biggest news is that what came out this week is that the Bush administration, it's obvious now, had no plan of how to govern Iraq post-war. On the other hand, it turns out that there's at least one element in Iraqi society that had a plan for how to defeat the Bush administration once it set up shop in Baghdad, and it's working very, very well right now to do that.
And the Bush administration is playing right into their hands.
Exactly. It's working very, very well. And I want people to realize that what you have going on in Iraq right now is a guerrilla war, and it is well planned, and it is showing signs of coordination at high levels, regardless of what the U.S. military is saying, what people in Washington, D.C. are saying, and what you're reading in the newspaper. There are signs that it is being very well coordinated. And the biggest sign of that is the fact that Baghdad has been completely cut off. There is no electricity there. There hasn't been since Sunday, late Sunday night. Two pipelines, very strategic pipelines that brought fuel to the city, were bombed early in the week on Sunday and again on Tuesday in order to prevent any gas or oil reaching Baghdad and central Iraq, and that literally crippled the power substations for all of central Iraq. Right now, you have temperatures of 110 to 117 degrees during the day in Baghdad. There is no electricity, so there is no water being pumped to anybody's houses. The water is completely shut off. There is no electricity, so there is no air conditioning, no refrigeration, no cold drinks or ice. And literally, Baghdad is melting into absolute chaos. It is a griddle there. People, it's a wonder that people are not out protesting. Of course, it's probably too hot. I think it's going to be only a matter of days before you see people out at night, literally mobbing the U.S. authority, demanding some kind of action, as people start to get very, very sick and die from the heat, and as children and old people begin to die from the lack of clean water in a city with millions of people in it. You're going to see just major chaos erupt in the next few days, and it's not likely to get much better. We've also seen this week very well planned and targeted assassinations of Iraqis who work in the electrical infrastructure around Baghdad.
Can I ask about that also? How quickly can that pipeline be repaired?
Not quickly at all.
That's the question. Yeah,
not quickly at all. And it's unclear as to whether or not it would remain in functioning order for very long. Some of these pipelines that are being bombed, and now it's been six in the last 2 weeks that have been sabotaged, with most of those coming this week. Some of those pipelines that have been bombed are buried pipelines. So the people who targeted them had to know where they are, had to know how deeply they were buried, had to dig down to them and place explosives around them in order to sabotage them.
And had to know their function.
Yeah, had to know exactly the connection there. and they've done a very, very good job of it. And it's quite obvious to me, and it should be obvious to the reporters who are reprinting false assurances from the U.S. military that it's not a coordinated campaign. It should be obvious that it is a coordinated campaign. These people know what they're doing, and it is designed to turn central Iraq into a cauldron that is going to people rising up and fighting against the Bush administration is going to make the U.S. interim authority in Baghdad, it's going to make their job just way harder.
Are there developments quickly?
Yeah, security in Umkhaza. Folks might remember that Umkhaza was the first city liberated during the war, and it's the major port city in the south. It's the major link of goods being imported into Iraq, and folks might remember that it was the first really secure place in Iraq. Well, the U.S. Agency for International Development issued a report last Friday saying that Umkhaza remains a major security problem and has become more problematic in recent weeks. You have, and they reported that armed men have looted food straight off of ships carrying humanitarian supplies that are docked at the port. Now, I should point out that this is a good and very efficient way for a guerrilla army to feed itself, and it's been done in many, many countries around the world where you have civil wars and guerrilla armies operating, that they will loot and steal humanitarian supplies in order to feed and equip their own troops. And I would like to stress that that is happening right now in Iraq.
You also had six British soldiers dying a couple of days ago in a city in southern Iraq, which was, again, considered one of the safest and most tranquil cities in Iraq during and shortly after the invasion itself.
Yeah, it's been called mob violence, but I'd also like to point out that there were a couple of very well-planned ambushes in that same area at the same time, and that those ambushes involved heavy weaponry and a lot of people shooting at a British helicopter in one instance and at British troops in another, so that it seemed that even though you might say it's mob violence, I'm not persuaded.
Yeah, and this was the first time that the British had been targeted in any kind of systematized way, suggesting, of course, that it's specifically been the Americans who have been targeted in the past, which is something that hasn't not come out here.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how that sways the British stance on this whole thing.
Yeah, they're already talking about withdrawal.
Yeah, they're already talking about they don't want to be stuck there for the next 10 years the way the Americans seem to want to.
Mm-hmm. All right, just a few minutes left. So anything else quickly on that, or we can...
Let us move on.
Yeah,
all right.
Let's move on.
Well, Mr. Parrish, I understand your fine publication...
You're going to put it on me, huh?
That Eat the State, which of course all volunteer operation is in need of a little support.
Yeah, we're scrambling just a little bit. And for folks who listen to this program know, it started literally the same week Eat the State did 7 years ago now in the fall of 1996, way back last century. And and of course, Maria and I both edit for that, and we had a bit of a financial jolt this week, and it's always been kind of a shoestring operation anyway, but our major expense, really our only... we have three expenses. We pay for layout services. We pay for postage for people who subscribe through the mail and the printing for the print newspapers, because in addition to a lot of people see us on the web, but especially here locally in Seattle, a lot of people, the folks that can find us, get it through the print newspaper. And the fine place that has been very patient and tolerant in dealing with our unsteady finances over the years, Pacific Publishing, has decided that they are going to a job by job accounting system, and so suddenly we have to come up with the three or four issues that we are perennially behind and owing them, and next Tuesday
they're not going to extend us much credit anymore.
So yeah, exactly.
I think it's just a reflection of the economic downturn. Businesses have to look at their cash flow, and Pacific Publishing is doing that.
Yeah, and know, it's certainly not anybody's fault, but it does leave us in an enormous pinch because we are scheduled to go to press next Tuesday and are probably still about $500 short between now and then. So what we wanted to do was get out the violins and ask for anybody who could, you know, give us a short-term donation if you've been able to get useful information out of Eat the State in the past. If you appreciate it as a community service, we could sure use your financial help right now. Summer is traditionally a slow time of year for donations for us anyway, and for advertising as well.
This year in particular, so, we've been kind of low on the donations.
Yes, because
we've looked at our finances and our subscriptions are up, and other sources of revenue are pretty good, but donations have dropped way off.
Yeah, and you know, we certainly hear from a lot of people that it's appreciated in the community. So if y'all can help us out, please give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461. If you can drop something in the mail today so that we would get it in the mailbox, you know, Monday or Tuesday, that would be great. Also, the mailing address is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145, and I'll give both of those again very briefly. The phone number again, and you know, we can make donations to come pick something up if need be, is area code 206-903-9461, and the mailing address, Eat the State, P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And you know, it's been a community supported paper for the last 7 years, and we really like to keep doing it, and you know, we really enjoy doing it, but we have to have the cash.
All right,
that's the deal.
You can also donate from our website, which is eatthestate.org.
Oh yes, that is true too.